Rumpel and the Gentle Art of Blackmail by John Mortimer. Adapted by Richard Stoneman. Starring me, Timothy West, as the elder Horace Rumpel, and Benedict Cumberbatch as the younger Horace Rumpel.
And as we raced across bright knots of rail past standing pullmans, walls of blackened moss came close, and it was nearly done, this frail travelling coincidence.
I am not, it has to be said, a huge fan of Philip Larkin. And yet, whenever I think back to the spring of 1964, I think of his Wits and Weddings. Perhaps I'd been reading Larkin's poetry at the start of my train journey to Oxford, on that bright morning when I embarked on my mission to help a young man by the name of Peter Vernon. I really can't remember. I know, however, that all of my clients were innocent until 12 old darlings decided otherwise. But in the case of Peter Vernon, I believed, on first meeting the boy, that perhaps he wasn't as guilty as some I'd defended.
Dreaming spires of Oxford.
I had mixed feelings about returning to Oxford. A city where, as an undergraduate, I'd enjoyed remarkably happy times, but also moments of deep, deep despair.
The same, I suppose, could have been said for Peter Vernon, a junior gardener at St. Joseph's College. His alleged crime was blackmail, which is looked on with grave disapproval by the powers that be. But away from the long arm of the law, it's an essential part of family life. When used, however, it does require a certain amount of basic skill. The good blackmailer should utter a threat which is short, clear, and perfectly possible.
Back in the 1960s, my wife Hilda still had that lesson to learn.
Rumpel? We must have new chair covers.
Picture me earlier that morning at breakfast with She Who Must Be Obeyed and our infant, Master Nicholas Rumpel.
We can't entertain anyone in this flat. Not until we replace those dull, old covers with brand new ones. Rumpel, are you listening to me?
Of course not, Hilda.
Was what I thought, but didn't say.
I'd be far too ashamed to open the doors and welcome our guests.
What guests?
Whoever we invite for luncheon, tea, sherry, dinner.
That's a lot of food and drink to consume on one visit.
They would be served on separate occasions, if we were ever to be at home.
We're at home now, Hilda.
But we are not entertaining.
Speak for yourself.
Nor shall we ever entertain unless we do something about our chairs.
I'm afraid I have a train to catch for Oxford.
Are you going to let me buy new chair covers or not? I shall need £20.
How much?
Rumpel, I'm giving you fair warning. If you don't give me the money for new chair covers to brighten up our living room, I'll
do what, Hilda?
I haven't quite thought of the consequences yet, but I'll take a most serious view. I promise you that.
She Who Must had a lot to learn about the gentle art of blackmail. But I had no time to pass on any advice that particular morning. I did indeed have a train to catch from Paddington in a westerly direction. It brought back memories of travelling to Oxford as an undergraduate. I read law at Keble College, and I must say, law is a subject which I never found of much interest. People in trouble, yes. Bloodstains and handwriting, certainly. Winning over a jury, fascinating. But law. As the train arrived in Oxford, I thought what joy it was to be away from London, far from the terrors of Judge Bullingham, from my clerk Henry, from She Who Must Be Obeyed, and from everyone else who knew me.
Rumpel? No, it's never Horace Rumpel.
Well, sometimes it is.
I'd been accosted by a middle-aged man with jet-black hair whose parting revealed a thin margin of grey that had yet to be dyed.
Thought so. You remember me, of course.
Of course.
though a subtle reminder wouldn't go amiss.
Humphrey Grice, one of your tutors at Keble. I taught you Roman litigation and quasi-contract jurisprudence.
And not a week goes by when it doesn't come in useful at Isleworth Crown Court. And you, Mr. Grice? Are you still coaching undergraduates in the joys of negotiorum gestio?
No, Rumpole. I rise above the minutiae now. I am the senior law tutor.
At Keble?
No, at St. Joseph's, as a matter of fact.
St. Joseph's?
It's a perfectly respectable college with a growing academic reputation.
I have nothing against the college. I'm merely surprised by the coincidence. You see, I'm here to deal with some legal business concerning St. Joseph's.
Legal business?
I can't really talk
about... Not the principal and the gardener. But in that case, you must dine with me tonight.
Well...
I won't take no for an answer, Rumpole.
It's kind of you, Mr. Grice.
Call me Humphrey, please.
Humphrey? But I really ought...
Mr. Rumpole? Mr. Rumpole? Oh, I'm so sorry I'm late. I'm Sue Galton, article clerk with Newby and Paramore. Your instructing solicitor in the Vernon case.
Vernon case? So I'm right.
I have a taxi waiting. Can I take you to the prison?
Yes, go to prison, Rumpole. And I'll see you at St. Joseph's tonight. 7 o'clock.
Tell me all about our client.
Peter. Oh, he's lovely. Quite gorgeous, really.
I'm sure he is, but I was rather hoping for a little more detail concerning his time in Oxford. How he got himself into this pickle.
Well, he became a gardener at St. Joseph's. That's how he met Tufnell.
You mean Sir Michael Tufnell, Oxford Professor of Moral Philosophy and Principal of the College. He denies any physical impropriety with Peter Vernon, who he alleges had threatened to tell the world, or at least the senior common room, that Sir Michael had taken him to bed and...
But that's quite impossible. Peter has never been with a man. Has no desire in that direction.
How can you be so sure?
Because Peter's my boyfriend. We're going to be married. When you get him off this ridiculous charge.
That was an added complication. I couldn't see how I was going to question the defendant about his sexual proclivities without causing considerable embarrassment to his legal advisor stroke fiancé.
Peter, you poor thing, you look terrible.
I'm fine, really.
This is Horace Rumpole.
Hello, Mr. Rumpole. It's kind of you to come all this way.
Don't mention it.
I brought you some cigarettes, darling.
Oh, thanks, love.
They're French. Your favourite.
How are things in the Oxford Nick?
There's one or two decent screws. Sue told me you're terrific at getting criminals off. But you might have a bit of trouble with me.
Why is that?
Because I'm not a criminal.
Of course he's not, Mr. Rumpole. Does he look like a criminal to you?
What he looked like was a pubescent Greek god.
Let's go back to the beginning. How long did you work at St. Joseph's?
About 10 months.
You met Sir Michael soon after you started?
Yes. Yes, he came up to me in the garden one afternoon. He was very nice. That first week he brought me glasses of sherry, cigarettes, and we talked.
About?
All sorts of things. Music.
Oh, Peter loves his music.
And opera. He told me I was just like Siegfried, Wagner's Siegfried. Asked me if I'd like to come up to London, go to Covent Garden. We had dinner at his club first.
Where was that?
Somewhere in St. James's.
Did you come back to Oxford that night?
Sir Michael drove me up, yes.
And then?
He dropped me at my room, near the station.
After that?
After that, we went to dinner in London once or twice. Oh, and I had tea with him in his rooms a few times.
And that's all?
Yes, that's all.
It was certainly all I was going to get, with his fiancée sitting beside him. So I made a point of suddenly spotting the time.
Oh, my word. I must get a message to my clerk before he leaves for luncheon. Miss Corkran, would you be so kind as to run to the end of the corridor and ask if you could telephone my chambers?
Surely you can do that yourself when we get back to my office.
Oh, it'll be far too late by then. Ask for Henry. Tell him I'll be fine for the Inner London sessions on Thursday. Thank you so much.
But...
Quick, before he takes his place at the bar of the Crown and Sceptre.
She went reluctantly, almost as though she were leaving her lover alone with a rival.
Peter, I can't get you off this charge unless you tell me the truth. Would Miss Galton rather marry a free man who's had a few surprising experiences or wait 5 years for a convicted blackmailer? You went to bed with Sir Michael and he gave you presents in return. Isn't that the story?
How did you know?
Because that's always the story.
It started after Siegfried. Should I be telling you this? I know it's not legal, but is it me or him who's broken the law?
Doesn't really matter at this precise moment. What you tell me is absolutely confidential. But if that happened, you're both guilty of gross indecency. No matter who did what, to whom.
I thought the law was going to change.
It's possible, I suppose, that someone might read the Wolfenden report and actually do something about it, but I doubt it. The people who make those decisions, they're not very fair. I'm not very keen to change anything. For now, we have to hope you're acquitted of blackmail, in which case you can forget about allegations of gross indecency.
I let him do it. Out of politeness more than anything. You know, like the way you're taught to say thank you after a kid's party. He bought me dinner, took me to an opera, so... I don't even think I liked him that much. It was his world I liked. The way he talked, the music he played, that freezing club of his with the old paintings and the rotten food. I was very grateful.
He gave you money?
Checks. A few times. He must have been mad to do that, mustn't he? His signature on bits of paper.
And you were mad to pay them into your bank account. Why keep the money if you weren't, in fact, a blackmailer?
Sue and I, we're going to get married. We've got a lot to save up for.
He also gave you a cigarette case.
After the checks, yes. It was gold. Gold-plated, anyway. Thought it might be worth a bit.
Your clerk, Henry, he knew nothing about the Inner London sessions on Thursday.
Oh, really? Perhaps it was Friday.
He didn't know what you were talking about. Have I missed anything?
Nothing of any import. Merely chit-chat. Now, let me leave you alone. Peter, my advice to you... Always tell the truth.
Not something I'd say to most of my clients. But in this case, if there were lies to be told, it would be the professor of moral philosophy who'd be telling them.
Good evening. I'm here to see Humphrey Grice, the senior law tutor.
Mr. Grice? Certainly, sir. You're to go to the senior common room. Where they were all expecting you.
There was, in fact, a whole flock of dons, sipping sherry and trying not to trip over their tattered gowns as they mingled and gossiped before going through for dinner at high table. I suddenly realised I'd be expected to dine in very close proximity to the principal of the college, the principal witness for the prosecution. I told Humphrey Grice it really wasn't on.
Don't be so silly. Sir Michael won't mind.
Well, there are rules, you know, rules about counsel's contact with witnesses. If the judge were to learn that I
see you have a guest tonight, Humphrey. Ah, Sir Michael. May I introduce my old pupil, Horace Rumpole? They call him Rumpole of the Bailey.
Well, down the Bailey.
They call me Principal of St. Joseph's. Down St. Joseph's. So glad you could join us, Mr. Rumpole.
We're starting with gull's eggs tonight, accompanied by a rather seductive sancerre.
How lovely. But I wonder if I could have a word over here, perhaps, please?
I took him to a quiet corner and explained my rather awkward situation.
Humphrey Grice invited me to dinner, but I should tell you, Sir Michael, that I'm appearing for Peter Vernon on the blackmail charge.
You will do your best for him, won't you? I feel so sorry for the poor boy.
But it's no doubt embarrassing having me here, no?
Why should it be embarrassing? Unless you intend to eat your eggs without first peeling off the shells.
No, no, I am familiar with gull's eggs and with Sancerre. Though, in fact, I am more of a claret man myself.
Excellent. And, of course, Rumpo, we won't talk shop. Benedict Domine.
Sir Michael said grace, standing in front of the paintings of former principals of St. Joseph's, who had concealed in their gentler academic lives who knows what strange secrets, without ever having to give evidence in a criminal court. Amen.
Don't you think Sir Charles Dilk would have made a rather good Prime Minister if he hadn't been caught out by his sexual indiscretions?
I'm not sure I can really...
But Rumpole, you must agree, if a man can't run his private life, it's quite obvious he can't run his country.
I suppose we've all got things we'd rather not have broadcast to the nation. Probably just bad luck if you do get found out.
Quite right. Dilk had bad luck.
It's not luck. It's the use of a little bit of common sense. What is a scandal, if I may ask the rhetorical question?
Well, I've always...
Rhetorical, Humphrey. A scandal is a secret that gets found out. It's a subject for lies and cover-ups. If you don't lie, if you don't try and conceal, then there's no scandal. If you want to kill a scandal, tell the truth.
Is that what you intend to do, Principal?
Since you have the bad taste to ask the question in the presence of a guest, the answer is unquestionably yes. Will you stay the night, Mr. Rumpole?
No, I really ought to be heading back to London, thank you.
I'm sure Grice can sort out a room for you.
Yes.
Could you pass the salt, please? And I see your glass is empty.
Oh, thank you.
After all seven courses had been consumed and copious amounts of wine imbibed, I telephoned She Who Must, gained her permission to stay the night, then followed a porter across the quad.
Mr. Grice has been after the principal's job for years.
Has he?
Oh, yes. He was runner-up when Sir Michael got elected. It was Mr. Grice what started all the rumours about the gardening boy.
Do you think they were true, the rumours?
Well, not for me to say, sir. But Mr. Grice seemed to know an awful lot about Sir Michael's trips to London with the gardening boy. And if anyone can sniff out that kind of business, it's Mr. Grice.
When you say that kind of business, what exactly do you mean?
Oh, you know, sir. The love that dare not speak its name. Sodomy.
Mr. Grice can sniff it out, can he?
Always pretends to be shocked at the very idea of two men, you know. Calls it repulsive, calls it unnatural. But methinks he doth protest too much, if you follow my drift, sir.
Yes, it's not too tricky.
So, when Mr. Grice saw how friendly the principal was being with the gardening boy, he couldn't wait to tell anyone who'd listen how outrageous that kind of behaviour was. He spread the word round the senior common room that Sir Michael was up to no good with the gardening boy.
And you don't believe the gardening... my client, when he said that nothing ever happened?
Well, he would say that, wouldn't he? And Sir Michael, he's Sir Michael. He's the professor of moral philosophy. Who wouldn't believe a man like that?
Yes, well, quite so.
The integrity of the Professor of Moral Philosophy was exactly what I was afraid of. Who indeed would believe the word of an alleged blackmailer against a man like that? After an uncomfortable night in my guest room, I wandered through the town to a second-hand bookshop in the Turf, where I propped myself up to read a tattered volume of memoirs by some long-dead legal hack. A voice like tearing metal pierced the silence.
You do actually read books, then? Your life isn't entirely practical.
Humphrey, how extraordinary to see you again. Almost as if you'd followed me here from college.
You slipped away very quietly last night. I was going to cross-examine you on the subject of the principal.
I don't think...
There's no possible doubt that he's guilty. That relationship was definitely physical.
Luckily for you, there's no one within earshot to hear that slanderous allegation.
Slanderous? Jem's the porter, the man who showed you to your room last night. He saw young Peter Vernon coming out of the principal's lodge at dawn. Dawn! What do you think of that, Rumpole?
I think, if I may say so, Humphrey, that your interest in the law doesn't appear to be entirely academic.
Morning, Rumpole.
Erskine Brown.
I met the principal of St. Joseph's yesterday. He said you'd join them for dinner.
You met Sir Michael Tufnell? Why?
Wants me to prosecute the blackmailing gardener. You're a guinea, yes? Sir Michael. Charming fellow. Enormously brave about this case. Frightfully embarrassed, too, of course.
Well, not half as embarrassed as my client.
It really is an appalling thing to happen to a man who has the Order of Merit.
Well, if he didn't want it to happen, the OM shouldn't have rushed round to the OB.
OB?
Old Bill.
But the poor chap was being blackmailed.
Isn't that for the jury to decide?
How do you feel about defending blackmailers?
Much as I feel about defending anyone. Glad of the money.
But it's such an extra loathsome crime.
Which is why Peter Vernon will be defended with extra care.
Ah, you're quite impossible, Rumpole.
It's what my wife says on a very frequent basis.
Well, then maybe you should change your wife.
Too late now. Hello?
Mr. Rumpole? Sue Galton. You asked me to find the date of Tufnell's first visit to the police.
Oh, yes. Just a moment. Do you mind, Erskine Brown? Rather delicate matter.
Absolutely. Just pretend I'm not here.
I don't want to pretend. I'd rather you weren't actually here.
Oh, take your point. Off I go, then. I meant to say hello to that new girl in the classroom, anyway.
Miss Galton?
Yes?
Yes, I wanted to know when Sir Michael asked the police to help him.
He went to see them and said he was being blackmailed on the 1st of November.
And what about the checks? When exactly were they written?
1st of August, 1st of September, and the 2nd of October.
So all before the principal went to the police?
Yes.
Now, Miss Galton, I want you to find out about the cigarette case. Get a photograph. Go round the Oxford jewellers, find out when Sir Michael bought it.
When he bought it?
Yes, the date's important. Find out when.
Do you think that's going to help us?
Oh, I very much doubt it.
Was what I thought but didn't say.
I really don't know.
Was the best I could offer.
Good luck.
And so, hardly bursting with confidence, I found myself in Oxford Crown Court. The red judge in charge of proceedings was Mr. Justice Everglades, a lazy, confused and slightly deaf old sweetheart, with a vicious habit of nodding off after lunch.
Yes, Erskine...
Brown, my lord.
I'm so sorry, Mr. Brown.
No, Erskine Brown.
What?
The name. My name is... Erskine Brown.
I'm aware of that. I'm still waiting to hear the case with the prosecution, which I hope will begin at some stage this afternoon.
Yes, my lord, I'm much obliged. Members of the jury, We may be able to forgive some forms of criminal activity, but blackmail, you may think, is a truly unforgivable crime. Blackmail is a slow poison which feeds on its victim's fear. And, of course, the higher the position a man reaches in his public life, the further he has to fall and the more he's got to lose. And no one, you may think, is in a more vulnerable position than the distinguished head of an Oxford college. A man like Sir Michael Tuffnell, professor of moral philosophy and principal of St. Joseph's in this ancient university. But the mere fact that blackmail is a crime, which we all hate and despise, mustn't make you more ready to assume that this young man, Peter Vernon, is guilty.
With the words, "Peter Vernon is guilty," ringing in their ears, the jury were distracted by the arrival behind me of Miss Sue Galton.
Ah, Miss Galton.
I leant back and she whispered,
"No luck with any jeweller in Oxford."
"Then you must go further afield. Try London."
"Rumpel, please."
"I have an idea that Sir Michael might have bought the case when he stayed at his club in St. James."
"Rumpel!"
"Just across the road from Bond Street and the Burlington Arcade."
"My lord, it really is too much that my learned friend wishes to conduct conversations with instructing solicitors when I am still trying to address the jury."
"You have more to say, Mr. Erskine?"
"Brown, my lord."
"Mr. Brown?"
"My lord, if I have interrupted my learned friend's train of thought, I do apologize."
"Mr. Brown does seem a little put out."
"Should I go now?"
"Go, go." It may be that your lordship feels the jury have heard quite enough for one day."
"But I've still got..."
"If your lordship wishes to see us all at 10 o'clock tomorrow, or even 10:30, I would have no objection whatsoever."
"Ah, that seems a very good idea, Mr... members of the jury, I would hate you to miss a vital point from Mr... when you're tired and your concentration is beginning to... 10:30 tomorrow morning."
"All rise."
"Rumpel, what on earth are you playing at?"
I wasn't playing at anything. Just gambling on the possibility of Miss Sue Galton coming up trumps the next day. As for that night, I dined not at High Table, but in the snug of a pub opposite Christchurch. I was halfway through my steak and kidney pud when a familiar grating voice interrupted my supper.
"Not much progress today."
"Humphrey, what a surprise."
"Budge up."
"Oh, please do join me."
"Yes, I was watching proceedings from the public gallery. The trial had barely started when you chose to close proceedings."
"Yes, well, juries tire very easily. You must always leave them wanting more."
"Shouldn't you work them harder for the sake of your poor client?"
"I serve young Vernon best by getting the jury to like him."
"And what about you, Rumpel? Do you like young Vernon?"
"I have no feelings either way."
"Ah, yes. I've heard it said that detachment is essential to the life of a barrister."
"Being an academic lawyer, I doubt you'd understand."
"Then why don't you try to explain?"
"I'm not sure."
"Tell me how you sleep at night, knowing that Peter Vernon will go to prison for a very long time if you fail to do your job properly."
"I usually sleep at night by dosing myself with Pomeroy's Ordinary Claret, Chateau Thames Embankment. But this evening my prescription has been a few pints of Guinness. I forget how many."
"Is this really how you wish to live your life? You don't allow yourself feelings for your clients. You numb your brain with copious amounts of alcohol. Surely, now, you regret that your poor degree denied you admission to the privileged world of academia."
"If I had to choose between teaching boys from Eton and Harrow the complexities of jurisprudence, or defending Bertie Timpson on yet another charge of carrying housebreaking implements by night, I'd go for Bertie every time. And now, if you'll excuse me, I must prepare myself for the next enthralling chapter of the case for the prosecution."
"Well, I...
God knows what insightful questions Erskine Brown will think of."
Sir Michael, you are you not, the principal of St. Joseph's College?
Yes.
You're also the Oxford Professor of Moral Philosophy, Fellow of the Royal Society, and you hold the Order of Merit.
Yes, yes, and yes.
And when did you get to know the defendant, Peter Vernon?
It was about 18 months ago, my lord.
He turned respectfully to the judge, as any good witness should.
That was when he came to us as an under-gardener and general handyman.
Did you have any relationship with him other than as a college servant?
I think he became a friend. If I may explain, my lord.
Complain? About what?
No. No, I wish to answer counsel's question.
That's kind of you, Sir Michael, but it might be better simply to answer counsel's question.
Yes. Well, I had conversations with Peter Vernon.
In the garden, perhaps?
Don't lead him.
In the garden. I found that Peter was a very intelligent young man with genuine, if unformed, musical tastes. He'd done well at school, but his parents had opposed him going on to higher education, and he'd been unable to find a job which suited his very real talents. I thought that he might be feeling jealous of the young men of his age who were enjoying academic life at St. Joseph's.
And so you felt perhaps you should...
Felt perhaps I should invite him to take some part in the intellectual life of our community.
What a dear old philanthropist the great man was.
I invited him to my rooms, and we talked.
About?
About music and philosophy. I tried to have the sort of discussion with him I would normally have with an undergraduate.
I hate to have to ask this, but I must. Did Vernon, did the undergardener, the defendant, did he ever stay the night in the principal's lodge?
Once or twice. We were still talking until the early hours and suddenly realized how late it was. I put him up in the spare bedroom.
Of course, of course. And did you ever go to London together?
Again, I think it was once or twice. I took him to the Royal Opera in Covent Garden and to dinner at my club.
Did your friendship continue happily?
I'm afraid not.
Oh, dear. What happened?
One day, Peter came to me in the garden and said that if I didn't give him money, he would write to all my colleagues at St. Joseph's and tell them we had committed acts of gross indecency.
Which, of course, you hadn't.
Come on. Of course we hadn't.
How did you react to what he said?
Foolishly, I'm afraid. I knew I was innocent of what he was suggesting, but I was scared of the scandal.
Naturally, a man in your very vulnerable position.
And I worried that one of my colleagues, at least, might say, there's no smoke without fire.
So you gave Vernon some checks?
Yes, and also cash.
Amounting to 30 pounds. And then a gold-plated cigarette case, which cost you how much?
It was 6 or 7 pounds. But then I realized that if I went on paying Vernon, he could blackmail me forever. I decided that I must face up to the possibility of scandal and go to the police.
Well, I'm sure we all realize that required considerable courage, Sir Michael.
Please.
Thank you, Sir Michael. Just wait there, will you, in case my learned friend has any questions.
As a matter of fact, my lord, I do have quite a few questions.
Will they take very long, Mr.
With no sign of my instructing solicitor, I realized I'd have to pad out proceedings for as long as possible.
Sir Michael.
Rumpole, yes, Mr. Rumpole.
I'm obliged, my lord. Sir Michael, in your book, Morality and Modern Man, you said something to this effect. Modern man will do good and tell the truth for its own sake, not out of fear or respect for a possibly non-existent deity.
I did, yes.
And yet you began your evidence by swearing on the Bible.
Yes.
Why did you do that? If you don't believe in God, why didn't you affirm?
I said God was possibly non-existent. That means I have to recognize that possibly he does exist.
And on that outside chance, you took the oath as you did.
My lord, is Sir Michael being criticised for taking the oath in the usual fashion?
Unusual pattern?
Oh, no, my lord. I am criticising Sir Michael for trying to present himself to the jury as something other than he is.
Other than who is?
At which point, Miss Sue Galton burst in through counsel's door and made her way to the bench behind me.
If your lordship could bear with me for just one moment.
Oh, really? Not again?
I found the shop. Burlington Arcade. Round the corner from
just
the shop.
Just tell me the date he bought it.
As his lordship stared at the clock above the dock, Miss Galton gave me the information I needed concerning the cigarette case.
I do hope we can make some progress shortly.
My lord, I really do think...
It's really not fair on the jury to keep them any longer than absolutely necessary.
It might be best if you leave the court now.
Oh, no. I want to hear you in action, Mr. Rumpole.
I'm sure you do, but there are things you might hear that concern me.
I can't imagine what you mean.
And it's that very innocence that I wish to preserve.
I'm staying where I am, Mr. Rumpole, and there's nothing you can do to make me leave.
In that case, Miss Galton... Please don't blame me for what we are about to receive.
I turned to face the old darling, thanked him for his patience.
I'm much obliged, my lord.
What? For what, Mr...
And resumed my cross-examination of Sir Michael Tufnell.
Sir Michael, you are lying about yourself.
That wasn't actually a question.
The truth, actually, is that you and this young man were friends. Close friends.
I've already told the court.
And simply as a friend, you gave him presents from time to time. The sort of expensive gifts another man might give to his mistress.
I have no idea what a man might give to his mistress.
No. You never married, did you?
I have been denied that happiness.
So you have no one else to whom you can give presents?
I have no immediate family.
But you had young Peter Vernon as a friend. For a while.
I've already told the court why I gave him that money.
Because you were afraid of being accused of something you hadn't done?
Exactly.
And you knew that Humphrey Grice, your senior tutor in academic law, would use any scandal to have you dismissed as principal... Because he coveted your position?
That was something I did have in mind, yes.
So you went to the police to make an allegation of blackmail. You went to them on November the 1st, yes?
I believe so.
I know so, Sir Michael, and the police did nothing for well over a month.
They were making inquiries, my lord, at Vernon's bank, for instance.
Be that as it may, Sir Michael... Was it not after the 1st of November that you gave young Peter Vernon the cigarette case? Might I have it, Usher? Exhibit 12, please.
The usher obliged.
Thank you, sir.
And I stood in court holding the heavy gold object. The jury looked interested.
No, no, I'm sure that can't be right.
It can't be right if you're telling the truth, can it? You wouldn't decide to put an end to the blackmailing by complaining to the police and then spend £6 or £7 on a cigarette case for Peter Vernon.
Certainly not.
Oh, Tufnell, my dear old sweetheart, you have delivered yourself into my hands.
But you see, that's exactly what you did do, Sir Michael. I will be calling evidence to prove that you bought this cigarette case on the 15th of December last year at a jeweler's in Burlington Arcade near your club and gave it to Peter Vernon as a Christmas present.
Why should I do that, Mr. Rumpole?
Because you wanted to frame Peter Vernon on a charge of blackmail.
Frame him?
You wanted to make sure that Peter Vernon wasn't going to be believed if he ever said something that could get you into trouble.
No.
You knew that Grice was onto your trail like an old bloodhound.
No.
You were worried that Grice might persuade Peter to say something defamatory.
No.
If he did, you wanted Peter to repeat those allegations only in the dock where no one would believe him.
He made me give him those checks.
Oh, you gave them of your own free will as presents. Presents at first. But then you realized those checks could be used to get Peter Vernon arrested and have him convicted as a criminal whom no one would believe. You might have got away with it, Sir Michael, if you hadn't wanted to add one final bit of evidence. The cigarette case that you bought for him in London
after you'd gone to the police.
From then on, it was downhill all the way. We called the jeweller from the Burlington Arcade. Then Peter Vernon went into the witness box, and the jury liked him. They even looked as if they'd chip in for a wedding present when he tied the knot with my instructing solicitor.
I'm very, very grateful, Mr. Rumpole. You must come to the wedding.
That's very kind, but...
I'm afraid there won't be a wedding.
What?
Can't. We can't get married. After what happened.
Nothing happened.
That's not what Mr. Rumpole said. He said you and Tufnell were friends.
Well, he would say that, wouldn't he? Because that's what we were. That's all we were.
I'm not a fool, Peter.
Please. Please, Sue, think about this.
No, Peter, it's over. All over.
I watched those two young people disappear and wondered how on earth they'd survive the years ahead. Together, or more likely, apart. If I'd known then what I know now about the 1960s, I'd have told Sue and Peter to bide their time. The sexual revolution was upon us. It would take no prisoners. In a few short years, anything they wished for might not only have been permissible, but would also have been positively welcomed, if not made obligatory. Back in 1964, Peter Vernon believed marriage would offer him a safe haven. Now, in my experience, marriage always turns into a minefield.
I'm not happy, Rumpole.
Neither, I imagine, is Sir Michael Tufnell.
I mean, I'm not happy with you.
Ditto, Sir Michael. Says here he's been forced out of his college by Humphrey Grice and has joined the panel on some kind of radio quiz show as an expert in morality.
Oh, put that newspaper down and concentrate on this brochure. It shows some of the chair covers I have in mind.
If I don't concentrate on your brochure, what exactly will you do?
I will have the entire mansion flat redecorated at a cost of £50. The bill will be sent to your chambers, and your clerk will be instructed to deduct the cost from your briefs until the account is settled.
Hilda.
Now that was short, clear, and perfectly possible.
Please may I see that fascinating brochure?
Of course, Rumpole.
Finally, she who must be obeyed had mastered the gentle art of blackmail. In Rumpole and the Gentle Art of Blackmail by John Mortimer, the elder Horace Rumpole was played by me, Timothy West, and the younger Horace Rumpole was Benedict Cumberbatch. Hilda Rumpole was played by Jasmine Hyde, Nicholas Rumpole, Louis Taflin Hyde, Humphrey Grice, Stephen Critchlow, and Sue Galton was Faye Casterer. Peter Vernon was Adam Gillen, Sir Michael Tufnell, Adrian Scarborough, and Claude Erskine Brown was Nigel Anthony. Other parts were played by members of the company. Rumpole and the Gentle Art of Blackmail was adapted by Richard Stoneman, directed by Marilyn Imrie, and is a Catherine Bailey production for BBC Radio 4.